So when you were that year in Los Angeles, you really just devoted yourself to the children, and then sometimes your friends would be party people, but you didn't make direct contact with the party then.
No, I didn't make direct contact
with
the
people. And then you moved up to Oakland or to Berkeley?
And then from here we moved first to Oakland and then to Berkeley. When Bernard entered the university, we moved to Berkeley, so he'd be close to the university.
Oh, what year was that?
That was about 1928, I think.
Oh, but you were first in Oakland then?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, and what, you had mentioned before that you'd moved around so much in that time period.
No, we lived first, when we first came to Oakland, the day we, after we came, we went to one of those, boarding houses or whatever you'd call them that were right near town. And the next day we went up to the Campanile and went to the university and everything to the town. You've been to Berkeley, haven't you?
Yeah,
so you know how beautiful the everything is. And I love California.
But you had mentioned, or Dorothy had mentioned, that in those, there was about from 1921 to 1928 that you moved a lot.
Well, we did. We, when we first came there, I was pregnant with Carol Jean. And that was, I became pregnant with her in 1924, didn't I? And she was born in 1925.
That was in 1922, right?
That was the first time. Well, after we lived there for several years, we came back to Los Angeles. And because he was transferred back to L.A.
Oh, when was that?
Yeah, I think it was. I think we came back here in 1922.
Oh, I see. So you were up there just for you were here for about a year, and then up there a year.
Yeah, and then when we came back in 1922, we stayed until 1924. Then we went back. Then in 1924, we went back to Oakland.
To Oakland.
That's when he changed the jobs and said, instead of selling cheese and meat, we were selling for Samsonite luggage.
I see. So each time you moved, you didn't make any efforts, though, to contact some of the party people or to...
Yes, I always kept in touch with them. You know, I always did keep in. And whatever I could do, I did. But I would not formally join back in the party that I had to attend meetings.
I see. You didn't pay any dues, and you weren't officially enrolled in the party.
No, that's right. Not until 1936. 1936, I went back and became active. Yes, then I became very. But I was active in things, you know. Anyway, even not being officially, but I.
Well, what sort of things would you?
Well, I would pass out leaflets, and once in a while, I would also speak at street corners.
Mm-hmm.
In Oakland.
Uh-huh.
You know, I would speak downtown at, do you know Oakland?
Not too well.
Well, there at 10th Street there, not near Whitburn and Swan and everything, where they used to have. So if they ran short of speakers, because I didn't like to speak, but if they ran short of speakers, I was pretty good in that.
What would you speak on?
On what was happening, that you need organization, you need to be recognized. The party had a right to be recognized, and the Constitution guarantees them that.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a great many from some that you would now call settlement people.
Oh.
That, you know, see, then I knew Anita Whitney.
Mm-hmm.
And
when did you first meet her?
I met Anita Whitney when we came back there in 1924-25. I met Anita Whitney about 1926.
I see.
And we became very great friends. I loved Anita Whitney.
So that brought you back into more.
Oh, yes, oh, yes. Yes, we gave money, too. All the time, whatever we could afford, we gave to the. Most of it to the International Labor Defense.
Mm-hmm. Now, when did you start getting active? The ILD was actually formed in 1925. Did you become active right away?
Right away. Mm-hmm. Yes, I did.
And there were several branches in Oakland and Berkeley. Which branch did you belong to?
Oakland.
To the do you remember?
Afterward, I joined in the. When we moved to Berkeley, then I just transferred to Berkeley.
Because in Oakland, there was the. Let's see. They seem to have different names. works always. Like there'd be the Sacco Vanzetti, no, there'd be the Tom Mooney chapter, or did your chapter have a name? Do you recall?
Yes, but mine was not the Tom Mooney. I'm trying to remember now. I think, and I'm not too sure of it, I think it was the Frederick Douglass chapter.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. And then would you go to meetings regularly at the ILD?
Yes, I went to meetings. I was the secretary for the ILD for several years.
Oh, for your branch there?
Yeah.
Oh, so what you did is instead of getting involved in the more underground activities of the party, you were more involved.
There weren't really so very many underground activities, really. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, the only time that I know that was really underground was at that time in 1950 when that happened. Mm-hmm. And that was the most stupid thing that ever happened.
Well, Barbara, speaking about that kind of thing, during the 20s, throughout the 20s, there was continuous factional fighting in the party.
Yes, there was.
How did you feel about all of that?
Well, I'll tell you some of the things. Some of the things at that time, too, that made Bernard Poo very disgusted. When there was a fight between Lovestone and Foster, mm-hmm. and they went to the Soviet Union, asked Stalin to arbitrate, I thought that was the most stupid thing I could think of. I thought, why did they have to go to them? They know that their problem is here. Here's where they ought to settle it, not leave it to Stalin. And Stalin decided that Lovestone was wrong. That made Lovestone such a son of a bitch. He turned against the party completely. Mm-hmm. He was really much better than Foster, much more intelligent than Foster.
So you were in the fight, you were really a Lovestone supporter then?
No, I was never a Lovestone supporter. We supported. I think we supported Foster, but I didn't think. I thought that was very foolish. I thought I saw no reason to go to Stalin to let Stalin decide. And after the night when Stalin was killing all those people, I thought, think of going to this monster to decide anything. You know, he's not everything. You see.
Well, the fight really between the Lovestone faction and the Foster faction really went on for over several years.
Well, about 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And during that fight,
when they went to the Soviet Union, Stalin decided that ended it.
That was it.
That's right. And Lovestone became an enemy of the party then, you know.
But up till the point that they went to the Soviet Union for them to decide. Did you actively support Foster, or you just?
Yes, we actively supported Foster. I didn't know enough about Foster or Lovestone. You see, don't forget that Lovestone was in New York and everything, and so was Foster. So they sent speakers to us, but it's only what they came and told us. You see, it wasn't as if we were living in it right there, where the people were actively working and knew as them. I never met I met Foster, but I thought he was a rotten speaker.
but what angered you was the fact that they went to the Soviet Union to
decide instead of deciding amongst themselves. That's the heel.
But in fact, they had decided amongst themselves against. It switched twice. First, in 1925, Foster was in control at the convention, and the Soviet Union sided with Lovestone. And then later, Lovestone was in control, and they then sided with Foster. But the membership, on both occasions, had decided differently than the Comintern.
That's right.
Now, did this disillusion you at all?
Well, I wasn't active enough in the party at that time to really have the... But I went to the meetings to hear the reports, but I don't remember. I remember that Bernard was sympathetic only to that. He never was really a member. Francis was, and Dorothy and I joined when she was only 14. So... And they had the, and I remember that Bernard was very disturbed about Lovestone and Foster. He thought that it was ridiculous that one should go to another country. And even Dorothy, I remember, said that when socialism comes to the United States, it will not come to the United States in the same way it came to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had never had any kind of a democracy. Here we have a bourgeois democracy, but it is a bourgeois democracy. They have had nothing about it. So there'll be nothing like that in here. And I can't see why we have to say, but, you know, she was very young, and that was the Young Communist League. And I'll tell you, frankly, in the Young Communist League, I thought they were so, such a kind of a looseness. Now we accept a lot of that, you know, it's old hat now. But at that time, it did mean something, you know. And I had to tell my girls, you're not fighting against that type of people, you know.
Well, Barbara, so during that period in the 20s, you were not so active in the party directly, but the children were then.
Well, Dorothy was, because she was in the Young Communist League, and so was Francis. Francis was a member of the Communist Party, but only for about 2 years.
Now, what did you feel about when Cannon became a Trotskyist? What did you feel about all of that? Here he'd been so...
I was just absolutely flabbergasted, you know, and we automatically hated Fred Cannon then. He read him out altogether.
Well, how did you feel about the fight between Trotsky and Stalin?
Well, you see, I'll tell you something. I always got into trouble, even with my own daughter, because I never felt the hatred against the Trotskyites that most of the party people did. Most of them that I know of just hated. And I knew a few of the Trotskyites, and I found them rather nice people. And I said, I couldn't understand it. I didn't agree that one should really ignore them and be afraid of them. And I know that when Carol Jean was arrested on the studio picket line, and one of the girls who was arrested was a Trotskyite, see, we were going in the same bus to come home, and I sat down near her. She said, "You're not afraid to talk to me." I said, "Now, why should I be afraid to talk to you?" She said, "Well, you know, I am a Trotskyite." I said, "So what? You were arrested for the same thing that Carol Jean is. You were on the picket line for the studios. So why should I?" She said, "Well, you know that most communists won't talk to me or anything." I said, "Well, I don't agree with that. Nobody's going to tell me who I can talk to. And I haven't any reason not to talk to you."
Well, you were really not willing to abide by the kind of discipline that the party demanded, were you?
Well, I wouldn't openly flout them, but I would, in our group, I would argue. And they used to say, "Well, you know Barbara, she's a stormy petrel," or something like that. They would always, so that they, because they knew that I would not blindly accept anything. You know, just like I told you that, and this was in the late 30s, when the party wanted, Elaine told me they wanted me to teach self-determination in the black belt, I refused.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you were, even though you weren't actively involved, you did know about all the factional parts and the struggles.
Yes. Well, I didn't know enough about it. And personally, I felt as if it was terrible, and I'll tell you why. I thought, now, it's enough to fight the enemy. Why do we have to fight amongst in our own ranks? Because we don't agree on every little thing. Essentially, we want a change in society. Why can't we at least work together with them on that? I just could never understand that. I thought it was enough to fight against the enemy who's opposed to you. I didn't believe in these things. I really never believed in anything like that. I remember one time one of them said, "You know, in some respect, Barbara, you strike me, you're more of a Christian." I said, "Oh, don't tell you. I'm an atheist. How can you call me a Christian?" Well, but you know, when you talk about working with anyone, they are even worse than the enemy. I said, how can you say that? Yes, they are. And that's the way they would feel, you know.
Well, Barbara, tell me, last time, remember I asked you if you thought when you first joined the Socialist Party and then the Communist Party, if you thought the revolution was around the corner. Well, remember in 1928 or so, there was an analysis that we were in the third stage of capitalism.
Yeah.
And there was then an attempt to do mass organizing, and people thought that, the workers...
That's right.
Did you really feel that?
I never did feel that it was very wrong. I said, and then my husband came home. He said, look, you people only associate with your people who think like that. I'm out in the wilds of the country, you know, where they don't even, for one thing, they don't even know you exist. You would have to transform them, and believe me, you'd have a hell of a time. And there's an awful lot of them who wouldn't. How are you going to have a socialist society with these people? They'd fight you tooth and nail. Because they believe in capitalism, not in the, they believe in individualism, and they wouldn't think it. You would have a hell of a hard time to convince them. And I, that people I go get thrown my bread, and most of them are like that. You're only a handful, believe me, compared to them.
So the analysis of the third period of capitalism didn't strike you as being valid.
No, it seemed to me that it was a little bit far-fetched.
I
heard the young communist speaker say, this is the third stage of the capitalism, the last stage of it, which just seemed to me kind of silly.
Because it seems to me from the research I've been doing now on it for today, that what happened was that with that analysis that this was the third stage of capitalism, there was a shift in about 1929 or 1930, even in the ILD, to mass organizing compared to the much smaller scale.
Do
you recall that kind of shift?
Yeah, but very slightly, because I wasn't so active in it. But there was a change, yes. There was a shift then, you know, because I began to see that I remember when Dorothy spoke much later than that, she said, you see, the mistake we made was in thinking that because the economic base in the Soviet Union had changed, that it had changed the people. She said, now we found out that deep are the roots, and it'll take perhaps another 100 years, not as we thought then, about 20, 30 years, but that was a mistake that they made.
Within your activities in the ILD, was there a shift as a result of this analysis for mass organization?
Not so much in the ILD, because they were a defense organization most of the time. As a matter of fact, primarily a defense organization. And they weren't so... but many of them who were the Communist Party members who were active in the ILD would carry the party fights right into the ILD, too.
Well, in your group in the ILD, for instance, what proportion of them were party members?
I would say about half of them were.
Mm-hmm. I forgot.
About half of the people were in the Communist Party.
At least.
In the ILD.
Yes, at least. Mm-hmm. But a great many others in the ILD, you found even some like the Jane Addams group, you know, who were kind of settlement people, you know.
Oh, I see.
Like, something like the Civil Liberties Union.
Because the party was really using the ILD to reach out.
Well, you see, the trouble with the party, everything they ever joined, it was to get in and capture it. And that's what the whole thing was. The party always said that they were the ILD. They made the policies for it, and
you don't feel that was true, though?
Huh?
You don't feel that was true?
Yes, I think it was true. I think it was.
And you
I found too much of that. That they went in, you know, to capture anything. I remember in the at the time when OSHA ran, I think that was about 1928, wasn't it, 29, something like that. A great many of the communists at that time really had a great deal of influence. But, so I remember that's when Don Healy was in, you know, and he was a much more faithful follower of all the things than Healy. And I told him, Don, this is foolish. This is just absolutely foolish and everything. And I said, you are really a blind follower because you say that you support this kind of a thing. There's no reason for that kind of a thing and everything. And he did wonderful work in it and everything. You know, he's a powerful speaker and everything. But I thought it was the most silly thing of I just never thought it was reasonable. You see, in spite of the fact that I was a radical, and had, but nevertheless, I never lost my common sense. And I thought this just didn't make sense. It didn't have any logic to do that. And I thought it was wasting one's strength. And look, the thing is that the ILD died. And I thought the ILD was one of the most worthwhile organizations they ever had.
So you thought that they really, that they went in and really ruined things by taking it over, in other words.
I think they did wrong because the many people who were very resentful because they saw what they were doing, you know, that they would try to superimpose their ideas or their tactics on them, and they resented it. And I remember that several members in the unions, that they had lost their jobs because the party had given them certain work to do, that they come out, showed the face of the party, showed the face of the, and they lost their job and everything, came to Dorothy and were very, very unhappy. Said, look, I showed the face of the party. The party didn't protect me. I'm out of a job, and I lost all influence and everything. And so Dorothy said, well, you see, I can't go ahead and tell you what to do, but one thing you have to learn to do, you have to know when you think it's foolish to say no, I won't do it. You always have that right. If you're going to be just a blind follower, then you're going to get it. What can I do about that? But I can't. I don't think it's right for the party to give you that, tell you. The party should not be your conscience. It can direct. You're studying the thing. You're doing whatever you can. But you always have to use common sense. Because if you lose your job, the party can't support you, can they? So what? They have no right to tell you that you have to go ahead and lose your job even. Because that isn't going to solve the question. Somebody else is going to get the job. We're going to work for it. And you have, the party can't support you.
So you feel that by the party really trying to take over things like the ILD, essentially it undermined its own influence.
That's right, but they didn't think so. They thought that the only way to maintain their influence is to increase their influence and allow no weakening of that influence, which I didn't agree with at all.
Well, were you unusual in thinking that?
Yes, I think I was. There were a few of them who went, you see, I found too much blind following without any question, you know, and everything. Whatever they said became what the Holy Writ were. You know, to me, Holy Writ is only silly. So, but for a long time, sure enough, even when I had a difference of opinion, I would think, well, I perhaps don't really know enough about things, you know. These are studying these all the time, and they know perhaps there's a reason that I don't really understand. And it took me a long time before I had the courage to say, no, I won't do it.
So for a while you would go along with things until you...
Yes, I went along with quite a bit of it, you know. And I, too, had the arrogance to think that if you weren't a communist, you really were ignorant. You didn't know what was happening in society. Only when you understood what communism was and you were a socialist, then only then did you really understand the real culture of the world and know what it meant to have an education, to have an understanding. If you didn't, or you just really didn't know very much.
Well, Barbara, when you became involved in the ILD, in what capacity would you serve?
Well, I was secretary for my group for several years, and I tried to attend any meeting of the ILD that I possibly could, only that I didn't stay too long, and most of the meetings that I did were in the afternoon, so I wouldn't have to leave Carol Jean.
Mm-hmm.
But
You were doing the street corner speaking? Was for the ILD?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I carried out anything of the ILD, I carried out.
You never objected to anything that they did?
No, whatever they did, I carried out. But I didn't believe in the Communist Party taking it over.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was foolish, because if they wanted to be communist, they would join the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
And to be there working side by side with them, with the same purpose in mind, the defense of all these workers who needed defense, that was the important thing, and not the capture from within.
Within your branch of the ILD, was there a fight going on between those who were communists and those who weren't?
I never saw it.
Uh-huh.
Most of them, even those who weren't communists, really went along with the communist line.
But there was never an ILD position, for instance, with which you disagreed?
None that was very strong or enough. I really never understood why it dissolved,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you still needed it.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the, like the one that was turning the, for the, for the foreign born, which was supposed to take the place of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that the ILD could have done a better job than the foreign-born organization.
Mm. Well, what sort of direct activities would you get involved in with the ILD?
Well, most of the time, the thing I hated doing, I did a little of it, is raising money. To ask people for money, I just hated it. But I did some of it, you know. But I never liked it. I never liked it. But I'd go out with literature, you know, and I would talk to people. I would talk to people all the time. Mm-hmm. I've been friends with all my neighbors. I don't know any of the neighbors mm-hmm. here. But at that time, I knew every neighbor, and I would get them, listen, if you know, and especially in voting, I was very active in that. For instance, Costello, who had been, he was a Catholic, and he had been a rabid Republican in the 15th district, I think it was. Yeah, said you couldn't get him out. For years they had tried to get him out. So there was a young woman, Ann Trojan. Now she hates my guts because we were critical of the Soviet Union. But I went with her. But many times I went alone, and we covered 300 homes. And see, we had printed a card. This was Costello's record. This is what he voted for. This is what he voted against. We covered every home, and we talked to everyone there. Is this what you want in a congressman? This is what he voted for. Is this what you want? No. Then vote against him.
This was in the 30s?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he was defeated, soundly defeated in Congress. And I said, you see, when you throw leaflets, many people just throw them away. But talking to people and having that record of his, there's his record. They could write to they can write and get his record. But here it is. This is what he voted for. This is what he voted against. Does he represent you? Is this what you want? And everything.
Well, did you campaign when Anita Whitney ran for the state senate in 1928?
Oh, yes.
And what would you do in campaigning?
I would go from the house to house, talk to people. I always went that. I didn't like to very much, but I did.
Mm-hmm.
I went from house to house and talked to people.
Was this in Berkeley or in Oakland?
In Oakland.
Mm-hmm. And what about, did you campaign? Foster was running for president that same year. Did you campaign for that?
No, I really didn't.
So when you would go house to house to talk about her, you didn't also bring Foster into it?
No, I would, I, if I did, I would, you know, just as if by, in passing.
Why was that?
Well, I knew that Anita Whitney, and I didn't have the whole tremendous admiration for Foster that some had, because I thought in some things he was stupid. For instance, I'll tell you, I went to a meeting right after the war, 1946, where this senator who was a real reactionary from South Dakota, I can't remember, he was a congressman at that time, and Foster was on the, they had told him that he could, he had the national broadcast, national hookup. And he said, they said, see, Mr. Foster, now would they allow in the Soviet Union, would they allow me to speak for anything? They wouldn't, but here we open the world, you can speak to the whole American people. Here we get, allow you. So Foster said, now there you've heard a first-class case of red baiting. And I had gone there with an English comrade who worked for the gas company. He had a mother, a blind mother, 80 years old. And he had been in this party, and he told me he was leaving the party. He was the smartest guy I ever met. And he said, I went with him to hear Foster of that. He said, now Barbara, tell me, here he is, the leader of the Communist Party, and listen to the stupid thing he said. Here he has access to speak to the whole people. He said, this is a first-class case of red baiting. What a stupid remark to make. Most people don't know what red baiting is. Said they heard the expression. And I said, what do you think he should have said? He said, well, you know what he should have said. He should have said, why does an American congressman talk about the Soviet Union right now, right after the war, we're already beginning to have unemployment. Why isn't he concerned about what he can do for the American people? He, as a representative, sent there at the Washington to sponsor the welfare of the American people, should be concerned about that, not about the Soviet Union. Whatever the Soviet Union, let the Soviet people take care of it. But let us be concerned right here. And why should a congressman be concerned? I said, you're so right. You're so, really common sense, wasn't it? And so when I made a report at my meeting here, I said, he said, you know, they thought I was terrible to criticize the posture.
Well, when you, during the Whitney campaign, when you wouldn't talk about Foster, was this your own decision then, or was there an attempt to not deal with that, to get more...
Well, they separated. I don't remember that they even tied in Foster's with Anita Whitney. It was a separate thing altogether. And they had leaflets for Foster, you know, and speakers. But Anita Whitney was different.
Mm-hmm.
But almost everyone who knew Anita Whitney loved her.
What, when you would go house to house and campaign for her, what sort of reactions would you get?
Well, you see, I would talk to the people. I said, now, you know, we, after all, even though our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence are remarkable documents, but unless we do something, don't forget that what Jefferson said, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, is just as important today as it was then. And if we didn't take cognizance, after we elect people, one thing we should know more about what they stand for. Then when we're there, we should watch them and see that they carry out what they said. Otherwise, you know how they fool us time and again. So we ought to know something about it. And
what sort of response would you get?
Most of the time, I say, they only... I can't remember except a few cases where they said, I'm not interested, I don't know anything at all about it. Most of the time they would go very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, if you remember very few cases that they didn't receive me in a friendly way. Generally, I like to have someone with me because I think it makes a better thing than going alone. Yes.
Uh-huh. And did you take Carol Jean with you when you were doing this?
Well, when I went, only, I don't know whether you know, there's a little guy in Santa Monica we call Little Jimmy Fontruz.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's a vegetarian thing. And most of, when I first met him, I could hardly understand anything he was talking about. But he talks a bit plainer now. He loved to go with one, but generally he proved to be sometimes a pain in the neck because if I couldn't understand him, other people couldn't understand him. Never. He was very devoted, but that isn't enough, you know, to have to know how to appeal to him. But I was really pretty good in selling things, and I hated selling things.
Did you sell the labor defender?
Yes, yes. And you know that I sold more literature than almost anyone in the country, because Dorothy said everyone knew me by, I never went anywhere without a bag of literature. Wherever I went, because I didn't know where I'd meet somebody, and I'd say, read this, read it. And I still feel that way about it. If only people would read and know and understand.
Now, Barbara, what you said before that you were arrested in 1929 or 1930. What led to your arrest? What were you doing and what?
And that was, we were protesting a labor organizer, Archie Brown, who is now one of the real killer communists. And I knew him from the time he was a little boy selling newspapers. And Edgar Owen, he was a, they were trying to organize the U.S. battery works, and they had been refused and thrown into jail. And we were picketing for to give, that they had a right to speak and they had a right to organize. It was right before the city hall.
Oh, you were picketing at the city hall?
Yes, and they said that was a prescribed, that there were places where one could picket, but you weren't allowed to picket there. And we were picket, and Anita Whitman was there. And, you know, a policeman was dragging a woman, Julia, who was a Ukrainian, and her name was Julia Wild, and she was Wild. She had just a short time before that kicked the policeman in the place where she put him out of commission forever.
Picketing City Hall, then, and the
police. So this girl, we called her, her name was Julia Wild. Mm-hmm. She was a Ukrainian, blonde, yellow hair and everything, and believe me, she was tough. And so when the policeman was dragging her, I got so angry, I said, kick him, Julia, kick him. And the policeman came right over and arrested me. Anita Whitney tried to, look, she has a little baby. Carriaging what? No, no. At that time, she was 3 years old. But she wasn't, no, she was at home. And he arrested me anyway. And that was the first, only time I ever was in jail for 3 days.
You were there for 3 days?
For three days.
What were you charged with?
Charged with disturbing the peace and picketing in the wrong, you had no right. It was illegal picketing there.
How many of you were arrested?
There were a bus. That group was arrested. I think there were 7 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the first time I'd ever been in jail. And, you know, there was 2 Negro women there. And one was about 60 years old, and the other was about 28 or 29. The one that was 28 or 29 was very interested in what were you arrested for. And the one that was 60 years old, she said, What did he do to you? I said, well, what did who do to us? What and everything? She said, what are you here for? I said, well, we were picketing because they wouldn't allow their organizer. For Christ's sake, haven't you got anything better to do than butt into somebody else's business, come to jail for that? I said, well, what are you in here for? Surely, if you're not shocked, this is what she said. Well, all I was trying to do is get a little fuck for myself. And they objected, what the hell did they care about? A 60-year-old woman, I almost died. I didn't hold anything. Then, you know, they had a toilet right inside for all 6 of us, 7 of us, used the same toilet. There wasn't even nothing but in front of everybody. No privacy, not anything. Right in the middle of that. I thought that was obscene. I said to the policeman who was taking our name and everything, I said, you know, before you were a policeman, you were a worker, weren't you? He said, yes, sure was. I said, aren't you ashamed of what you're doing? She said, what am I doing except taking your name? What am I doing that you object to? I said, that you're here altogether. Why are we arrested? He said, I didn't arrest you. What are you blaming me for? I didn't arrest you. He said, I wanted to tell you, I was in the unions at one time, but they're just as crooked as anything else here, too, and everything. He says, but don't blame me for that, you know. I'm only taking your name, he said. I have a wife and 5 children. I didn't have a job. And this is a job. He said, don't go blaming me, he said. I said, but don't you hate to do it? He said, what worker ever likes loves his job? Sure, I'd rather I wouldn't have to. He says, I don't like to. But all I'm doing is writing down your name. I'm not doing anything to you. I've never struck a worker in my life. He said, what do you blame? I said, well, I didn't know that. Most of them are not like you. He said, well, most of them are not like the same like other people either. Never forgot that policeman. But you know the food they served. The thick slabs of ham, you know, just all made me throw up to look at it. So the woman sitting next to me says, you can't eat it? I said, no, I can't eat it. She said, give it to me. I can't be so fussy as you. She said, I'm hungry. I'll be glad to have it. I said, well, here, take it.
What name did you use when you were arrested, Barbara?
So I used my maiden name, Herman.
Barbara Herman or Bessie Herman?
Yeah, Barbara Bess Herman. So the policeman came to testify against me. And I told you I had talked to the judge, Judge Bacon.
Oh, no. Well, wait, you were held in jail for 3 days?
Yes.
And they didn't come and put up bail for you?
Yes, they put up bail for us. Then we got out after the 3 days ago. Anita Whitney is the one who bailed me out.
Oh, she wasn't arrested?
No. Well, she hadn't done anything. She had only stood there. She was only standing there. And then the judge, when we were up on trial, before anything, policeman who testified against me, the judge Bacon said, what did Mrs. Herman say? He said, Mrs. Herman said, oh, how can the police do those things? Why are they doing that?